Well, this morning, since it's sad, is my last sermon with you guys, I thought I would do something different. Come on, it's April Fool's, you guys. Seriously? You didn't think you would get away with me not making an April Fool's joke this morning. But I do need your help. I need your help because I need to help you guys validate me and make me feel like I'm not a weirdo or some kind of freak. So when I start to tell this story about a regular occurrence in my life, when it becomes familiar to you, I want you to stick your hand up and then keep it up for the whole time. Sometimes, Jeffrey, right off the bat, you resonate with me. Sometimes when I'm driving out on the street, somebody does something erratic in front of me or cuts me off or is driving really slow in the fast lane with their flashers on or something like that. And as I come across it, it frustrates me and angers me because they're not following the rules of the road and they're impacting and affecting everyone else around you. And so I get angry with them. Amen. There's not enough hands up. More hands need to be up. This happens to me all the time, and I get so frustrated, I get so angry that many times I curse everyone who's around, and I say, yeah, that was when I had my beard styled a little differently. I curse everyone who's around, and I just want the DMV or the Secretary of State, whatever it is that controls the licensing of that area, I want them to come and snag everybody's driver's license away but mine, because I'm clearly the only good driver on the road. Now, this is something that is always been a part of my life as a Californian driving. We all drive aggressively, I think, in California. And I just have had this in my heart for a long time. And I think it's a great example of something that we all recognize in this world. And that is that there's something not right with this world. We all inherently feel it. We know it. We look around and we see the events of the day. We see things happening even in our own lives that we recognize there's something off about this. There is something not right. There's something bent away from the moral arc of the universe. And so there's something broken. There's something wrong in this. Now, one time when I was driving in my car and I was getting angry, I had a friend with me. Now, this was a non-Christian friend, too. And he was sitting there, and he just looked at me, and he said, Chris, you realize that all these people driving aren't doing this to you, right? He said, they don't even know you're here. There's no malice in their heart. They're not like, look, here's Chris. Let's cut him off. They didn't even know that I was there. And they went on about their day with no reflection on the events of that moment. Chris, you're only harming yourself and thinking the way you're thinking. What a better illustration for what's really wrong with this world. Because so many of us like to point out there to all those events that we aren't connected to and say that that is the thing that breaks the universe. Those are the things that lead to this immoral bend, brokenness to the universe. And so we want to point to them. But in reality, there's so much wrong in our own hearts that the place that most impacts and affects our lives is the brokenness inside of us. And if we were to begin to get healing in that area, then maybe even if it's just in your little corner of the universe, things might get better. Things might begin to be restored to the way they were intended to be. Things might get bent back towards the arc of the morality of the universe. This morning, as we come to worship, to church, I don't know what brought you here, why you're here. Maybe it's tradition. Maybe you're here every single Sunday. Maybe you just decided, hey, I'll give this church thing a try this morning. Whatever reason, you came this morning to worship a risen Savior, one who was not defeated by sin and death, but in fact, conquered sin and death by his own resurrection. And so you this morning, whether you knew it or not, came to celebrate the very thing that fixes the problem. I want to look real quick at what that fix is. What does the resurrection do for us? The first thing I think that we see in Jesus' resurrection, we see in Matthew 28:6, that Jesus' resurrection conquers sin and death. It says he is not here. This is what the angels said to the women, for he has been raised as he said. Come, see the place where he lay. He was not there. You see, this is a great story of victory, of conquering. This is probably the best story of victory ever been told. The ultimate underdog story, the story of a king who was not recognized as a king and instead was nailed to a cross, and yet that was part of his plan the whole time so that he might save those very people who unjustly executed him. What a great underdog story. And in fact, scripture goes way ahead of itself to foreshadow this. There's a great story in the Old Testament. Maybe you've heard it before. It was a time when the Hebrew people were up against the worst possible scenario. They were fighting against an invading army that they couldn't win against. They kept going up against them in battle, and they kept getting defeated one after the other. And it got to the point where they were standing there, and they were just completely, utterly deflated. And to make matters worse, the Philistines had this great hero who stood at least almost 7 feet tall, maybe more than that. And he stood out before the armies of the Philistines, and he taunted Israel. Oh, Israel, if your God is so great, send some warrior over here to fight me, and we can end this war one-on-one. And no one in Israel felt like they could answer that call. Until one day, one little shepherd boy who was destined to become a great king, David, showed up to be the armor bearer to the king, Saul. And he saw the taunting and he couldn't let it stand. He saw the taunting and he was like, no, you cannot taunt God's people this way, because my God is more victorious than the Philistines. And so he agreed. He said, I'll be the one sent out into battle with Goliath. And so Saul immediately puts his armor on David. And David's so scrawny, so small, that he doesn't even fit in the armor. He can't even really move around in it. It weighs him down too much. And so he decides to just take it off. And Goliath is sitting there taunting. And he comes and he takes 5 stones from the riverbed, puts one of them in his sling. And then he does what he does best. And he flings that rock as hard as he can and hits Goliath right in the head. And Goliath falls over dead. The ultimate underdog story. The ultimate story of the unimaginable happening. The one who seemed like they were going to lose, suddenly conquering over the much greater warrior. In the same way with Jesus, his disciples thought that he was done. They had given up hope. When he meets two of them on the road, they said, haven't you heard the things that have just happened in Jerusalem? We had put all of our hope in this man Jesus, and now he's dead. They had put all their hope in him, and yet he had been crushed by the ultimate enemy, by death. And they thought that all was lost. They were completely desperate. They didn't yet know that Jesus had raised from the dead, until he explained it to them and then broke bread with them that night. But Jesus conquered sin. And that's why in 1 Corinthians, one of the first and the earliest witnesses to the gospel, as the Apostle Paul wrote these words, he quoted one of the Psalms and he says, oh death, where is your victory? Oh death, where is your sting? Because it was no more. Jesus had erased it. No more does death hold us in its tight grasp. Death is destroyed in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. So Jesus' resurrection conquers sin and death. And we don't have to fear it anymore. It is tipped over. The grave is open. Second thing, Jesus' resurrection rolls back the tomb, Matthew 28:2, for an angel of the Lord descending from heaven came and rolled back the stone. Think about this. This is more meaningful than just simply the physical act of opening the tomb so that they could come in. Think about what death is for us. How many of you in your lives ever have ever feared death at some time or another? just wondering what is going to happen at the end, fearing what is going to happen. We don't know, and yet it's a part of our everyday experience. We know that death happens, and we've all lost someone to death. And so it's hanging out there as this kind of captor over us. And yet Jesus, when that stone is rolled away, it's not just so his body can leave the tomb. It's so that there's a symbol that that tomb is forever rolled away for all of us. And that death will no longer hold us permanently, that it will maybe have a small victory, but that in the end, we will be given victory. It was rolled back to the original way creation was supposed to be, where we have eternal relationship with God, eternal relationship with each other. When I was in my undergraduate, I took a class. What are you laughing at? I took a class from a man named Doc Beavers. He was a very loved professor in our school. I went to a little Bible college in Northern California, and he had been there for a long time, and people loved him. One of the reasons why people loved him is because he had a great preacher's voice. His voice rattled and had the timbre of the great 20th century evangelist. And so when he spoke, even in the front of the class giving a lecture, you felt like you had Billy Graham there preaching to you. It was wonderful. But one thing Doc was not known for was his great administrative skills or his memory. In fact, I had a friend one time who wrote 2 pages of nonsense in the middle of a report just to see if he would catch it, and he got an A on the paper. So I took a class from Doc, and I neglected to not do the main book report for the class, which was 20% of the grade. And I realized it way too late at the end of the quarter. And I went to him and I begged him for mercy. I said, Doc, it totally blew my mind. I had all kinds of other stuff going on. I worked almost full time through most of my undergrad. And so I just said, please, can I have 2 extra weeks to get this into you? It'll change my grade from a B to an A. And he said, Chris, don't worry about it. You got 2 weeks. So the next 2 weeks I worked, I read the book. Well, I had already read it, but I read the book again, and I did a book report for it. I turned it in. He got it, and I just forgot about it for the rest of the summer break. I came back from the summer break, and I went to register for my classes, and as I was sitting in with the registrar, she looked at me and she said, Chris, you can't register for this many classes. And I said, what? Why? She said, well, you're on academic probation. I said, I'm on academic probation? How am I on academic probation? I didn't get anything worse than a D last time. That was probably quite a few of my grades, but she said, well, you failed Doc Beaver's class. I said, I failed Doc Beaver's class? I didn't fail. I got at least a B in that. He was supposed to turn in a grade change form once I turned in a book report. And she said, we never received a grade change form from him. Here, go over to him and talk to him about it and get it worked out. So I went over, I talked to Doc. I trepidly kind of walked into his office and I said, hey, Doc, you know, I don't know what happened, but I turned in this paper to you. In fact, I even have it back with your grade on it and everything. What happened? Why didn't you turn in my thing? And he said, I turned it in. What are you talking about there? Go back there and tell them to check their records. So I went back to the registrar, and I told her what he said to me. And she looked at me, and she was really confused and puzzled. Then a light bulb clicked on. And she said, oh, that's what that was. You see, he came back to the office after school ended in the spring, and he had a loosely scrawled note on a napkin that I couldn't really read that said something, something, something passed, and then had his signature. And she said, I didn't know what it was, so I threw it away. She said, can you give him this form and have him sign it and bring it back? So I went back to his office. I didn't tell him that he had totally just left my fate to a scrawling on a napkin. I neglected to say that part, but I asked, I said, they need to resubmit this form because they don't have it. Can you please sign it? And so he said, yeah, let me look. And he pulled up his grade book and he looked through and he said, yep, Josh, it looks like you got an A. I don't know who Josh was, but I took that A and I ran right back to the administrator's office. I got registered for my classes. What a great feeling. What a great feeling to have something rolled back, right? When you thought it was over, when you thought there was nothing left, when you thought all was lost, and all of a sudden everything gets rolled back and you get a second chance, a second shot, right? What an amazing feeling it is. And yet, my illustration, that story, is not good enough for the story of Jesus rolling back the tomb for us. Because I wasn't really at fault in that, right? I had done my work and I had turned it in within the extension time, and it was a mistake in the administration and stuff. And so it wasn't really my fault. But in real life, in the life that we live, it is all of our faults. We are the ones who rejected God as our standard for what is right and wrong, for truth, and we decided to trust our own truth. And look how that has led to our world. Good or bad? Bad. When we've all chosen to do what's right in our own eyes, we've broken this world. We're the ones who have bent it away from the arc of morality that God built into it. We are the reasons for all the things that are wrong around us. And so when we see that Jesus rolls the tomb back, it's so much greater than just having an administrative error corrected on your report card. It's so much more than that, because God is giving you an undeserved second chance at life. A second chance, by the way, that cannot be taken from you, because it isn't based on anything you've done, but it's based on the work and the person of Jesus Christ and what he did in his ministry, life, death, and resurrection. Amen, that we have this wonderful, amazing second chance. Hebrews, one of the early letters, also says this: since therefore the children share flesh and blood, he himself likewise, talking about Jesus, shared the same things. He became flesh and blood, so that through death, he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by the fear of death. What an amazing, amazing message. We've lived our lives in fear and in trepidation about death, and yet now, because this tomb being rolled away, we don't have to fear it anymore. We can live our lives not in self-concerned fear about our vulnerabilities, but we can be totally vulnerable before the world to display the gospel of Jesus Christ so that others might hear the good news that they're free too. Not worried about any punishments, not worried about anything that's going to happen to us, because we trust in Jesus and in his resurrection. What a wonderful, amazing story, the fact that Jesus releases us from fear. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, for fear has to do with punishment. That's actually from 1 John, not from 1 Corinthians. It's a mistake there. Perfect love casts out all fear. So Jesus and his perfect love for the world, as he sacrifices himself for you and for me, casts out any fear that you might have about punishment, about death, and he gives you a new free life that you can live without fear, to trust in him. In Jesus' resurrection, the tomb was rolled back. In Jesus' resurrection, it gives us new life. Jesus' resurrection gives us new life. It's not just that it restores us to a second chance. Like I said, it gives you a new life that you can live into, that is something different, something better than the life before. Think about Jesus' own resurrection. It is said that we are going to be resurrected like he was resurrected. Now, he ate bread with his disciples. They touched him. He was clearly physical. He was like us. And yet, at the same time, he appeared suddenly in the middle of a locked room. And so he didn't seem to obey the rules of our universe as the way that we see it. His life was greater, grander, more vibrant than our lives. Notice this in the Gospels here, or in the letter of Colossians: when you were buried with him in baptism, you were also raised with him through the faith and the power of God, who raised him from the dead. And when you were dead in trespasses, God made you alive together with him, when he forgave us all our trespasses, erasing the total record that stood against us with its legal demands. He set this aside, nailing it to the cross. Notice what happens in the Gospels immediately after the resurrection. Here is, in every single account, all four Gospels, the main witnesses to the Gospels are who? Women. Now, many who attend regularly know that I talk about this a lot. This is significant, more significant than any of us can imagine, because in that day, women were not received to give testimony in court about something that was important. Their testimony was considered lower. They weren't given that kind of weight. So in order for the Gospels to record that not only it was women who were the ones who were the first witnesses, but they were the most pivotal witnesses of that resurrection to the disciples, it only was recorded because it's true. In those days, you wouldn't have written that down assuming that anybody would pay attention to your story. You would have excluded that from the story in order to try and make people listen to what the story. You'd put the disciples first and witnessing the resurrection and maybe put the women in there somewhere, but they weren't the pivotal witnesses to the resurrection. That would be how you do it if you wrote it in that time. And so the fact that it was written the way it was written shows that they were trying to record truth the best way that they could. They were trying to show that Jesus raised from the dead. But notice this, they're given a mission. The minute that they come to realize and know the gospel, to know that Jesus died for them on the cross and then conquered death by his resurrection, the moment that they recognize that, the moment that essentially they become new, they become Christians, they die with him in a baptism of the Spirit and they become alive with him in his resurrection, the moment that happens is the moment that God gives them a new purpose. Go tell. So this new life is more than just a life we get to live and do whatever we want. This life is filled with meaning. It's filled with purpose better than you've ever experienced before in your life. God will give you a mission when you come into this new life with him. A new purpose. Now, we all know what it's like to have new beginnings, right? How many of you have ever started a new job or a new school or a new move to a new town or whatever else? Isn't it good to leave behind all of your mistakes you made in younger years and be able to have a fresh start? I mean, when I came to this church, everybody all of a sudden started acting like I was their pastor. And I was like, whoa, that's weird, because at my last church, everybody realized I was an idiot. And you guys didn't realize that yet. I mean, you're growing into it a little bit, but you didn't realize it. It was like a fresh start for me. I could like make anything out of myself that I wanted. It was a fresh start. Well, imagine that. Imagine in your entire life that you have a fresh start, a new start. All that you've done that is wrong, not only in your past life, but even in the future, has been forgiven by Jesus Christ on the cross. Your slate has been wiped clean, and no longer does God look at you and see a sinner. God looks at you and sees the perfection and blamelessness of Jesus Christ and Jesus Christ only. And so you have a new life to spend and to use for his glory the way that you were intended to in the first place. To be his image bearer on this earth, to be a reflection of God so that other people can see you and worship him because he's so prevalent in you. This is the new life that God offers us in Jesus Christ. This is the new life found in Jesus' resurrection. If you are here this morning and you have never trusted in Jesus that way, if you've never thought about it much, if you've not let it impact and soak down into your heart and give you the ability to find that new life, that new purpose, that new mission in you, I challenge you this morning to at least explore it. At least look into the claims of Christianity. Talk with some people who know what they're talking about. It's worth your time, I promise you. At the very least, you could just say a prayer in your heart and see what God does with it. Hey, if God doesn't exist, it's just a simple 2 seconds waste of your time. If God does exist, I hope and I pray for you that he shows up and shows you how he answers prayer. And a prayer could be simple, something like this: Lord, I don't know if you're real. I don't know if you really died for me on the cross, but I know something's wrong. And I know I need you in my life. And so, Lord, please show me how I can live for you. Pray that prayer and see what he does with it. And if you don't know what to do, if you're confused and you need somebody to talk to, I made sure that my cards were on every single table out in the narthex except for the one with the donuts, the plastic table. No cards on that. But every other table so that you couldn't be confused. Which one was the welcome table, Chris? I couldn't find it. The one that says welcome on it on the side. Come on, people. But every table out there that's made of wood, if you look on the bottom left-hand side as you're looking at it, there is a stack of my cards. And if you need somebody to talk to, if you need somebody to answer questions, if you need somebody to pray with, I am here for you 24/7 to do that. Take the time, examine these claims, and determine whether or not this is something for you and that if God is calling you to new life in his resurrection. And what an amazing thing that this Easter came on the first Sunday of the month where we celebrate communion. Because what a great moment for us to come and to recognize what Jesus has done for us to begin to eat real food and drink real drink, which is Jesus Christ in his meal that he invites us to around his table. So as we come to this table today, let us recognize that God has done something great and new in us, restoring us to life.